Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Evan Horowitz. Consider this mix of combustible elements: a major elite university, charges of discrimination, and the future of affirmative action. It's all coming to a head next week with the beginning of a trial charging Harvard with discriminating against Asian American applicants. Harvard denies it, saying that they evaluate all candidates in a holistic way and that they're pursuing their established legal right to create a diverse student body. But Students for Fair Admissions, that's the anti-affirmative action group that brought the lawsuit, they disagree, arguing that while Asian Americans have the best academic records, they have the lowest admission rate among any race that apply to Harvard. We're going to speak with folks on both sides, beginning today with Ilya Shapiro. He's a senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, and as he wrote in the Wall Street Journal, he thinks, quote, "Harvard is too discriminating," end quote, in its admission process. He joins us from St. Louis. How are you doing, Ilya?
I'm doing okay. So the trial kicks off next week, so this is going to be a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it could turn out to be a big deal. I mean, let's start from the beginning, though, before we get to the big stakes. What exactly does Students for Fair Admissions take issue with in the Harvard admissions process? What is it they're trying to contest?
Well, the Supreme Court over the years has set various standards about how race can be considered in admissions decisions. It has to be one of many factors. It can't be a decisive factor. It can't be an automatic points or quota system, things like that. And then courts, when they're reviewing what colleges do, they don't just defer to the expertise of administrators, but actually drill down to see that race-neutral alternatives were explored, that the use of race is narrow, and things like that. So what the allegations here are that Harvard is using race impermissibly, and especially Asian American applicants are being harmed, because if you take the same level of qualification, including grades, scores, extracurriculars, community service, all the interviews, all that stuff, Asians get in at much lower rates than applicants from other ethnic backgrounds. And if indeed Harvard is doing it that way, then that would seem to violate existing jurisprudence without even opening the door to larger questions about should the Constitution allow race preferences at all.
So just so I'm understanding, it's not that it's impermissible for universities, public and private, to strive for diversity and to take race into account in that way. It's that there are narrow constraints on how they can do it, and that Harvard is violating the narrow constraints.
That's right. And the expert brought in by the plaintiffs, by the Students for Fair Admission, has run a regression analysis based on data, some that was already public, some that he got from Harvard during the discovery process and this litigation, showing that there's no explanation that he can, you know, this is why we're having a trial to find out from Harvard, but he can't find an explanation of why admission rates are what they are without taking into account impermissible racial discrimination.
So Harvard, they're defending their quote-unquote whole person evaluation. That is, their approach to applicants that looks at the, you know, the whole person, where race is one of many factors. So here's Harvard President Larry Bacall on Radio Boston in July, some of these factors.
We seek students who come from broad socioeconomic backgrounds, because that's part of our mission, is to create opportunity. We seek students who are geographically diverse.
Mm-hmm.
We seek students who are ethnically diverse. Having all sorts of students come together in a learning environment is the function of our admissions process.
Apologies to Larry Bacow, whose name doesn't rhyme with Macaw. But Ilya, do you think there's value in having diversity in an incoming class?
Depends how you define diversity. I think there's definitely value in having people who want to major in...
Let's narrow it and say ethnic and racial diversity. Do you think there's value in having racial and ethnic diversity in an incoming class?
I think there's value in having different backgrounds. I don't think there's value in judging people based on skin color. That's what, for me, it comes down to.
And you acknowledge, though, that the Supreme Court has said that that is a permissible focus of college admissions. Or no?
Right. It is as one factor among many and all of that. What's kind of tricky with what the Supreme Court has said, and this is specifically after the University of Michigan cases 15 years ago, it threw out this mechanical application of points for race, but it allowed and encouraged this kind of holistic review, which is what Harvard actually invented holistic review about 100 years ago as a method of potentially capping the number of Jewish admissions. So history is sort of rhyming in a certain sense there. But the problem that the Supreme Court set up is that by allowing this holistic review, the process is a lot less transparent. And some allege, including Students for Fair Admissions, that the racial preferences are even greater than were Harvard to use that kind of mechanical points or quota system that the Supreme Court threw out.
Now, so, I mean, one reason that colleges, there are a couple of reasons colleges, it seems, care about diversity. One is they want to expose incoming students to a variety of people from different backgrounds, and that's connected to the idea that people from different backgrounds bring different perspectives to the way they think, the way they act. There's also a sense that minority students in America have been underrepresented at elite universities for decades. Is that a concern of yours, that limiting universities' ability to consider race in the application process would disproportionately affect minority students who are already shut out of the admissions process in many ways?
Well, it's unclear that even members of racial minorities benefit all that much from preferences that put some people into institutions, into universities that are maybe above where they would otherwise be. And so they begin to achieve at lower levels, and they see that other people who are achieving at lower levels are also members of racial minority groups. And so they feel like there's some sort of structural or institutional, this phenomenon is called mismatch. But the problem that, you know, universities, if they want to engage in affirmative action and go out to high schools that are underrepresented and recruit, that's all fantastic. My problem, and I think this is the nature of the suit, is that you have people that are being admitted apparently solely or as a decisive factor because of the color of their skin. And that's not proper.
Solely, wait. Solely, that sounds too strong, right?
Well, as a decisive factor, as such a significant factor that it overwhelms other considerations, that as the statistics show, at any given level of qualification, it's that much harder to get in if you're an Asian American applicant than white, than Latino, than black. I mean, this is these sorts of statistics. It's we're not talking about kids who are just a small factor of many, but often it's the deciding factor. It looks like based on
what
we see,
or at least that's the charge in this
right.
particular case. Now, you said earlier that you're not sure racial and ethnic diversity is itself a value universities should pursue or be allowed to pursue. But let's assume then that there's let's say they want to accomplish some kind of diversity, right? And that's been endorsed. If not via race, what are the other ways universities could go about building diverse classes and diverse institutions?
Well, you want to have people of different backgrounds and interests and talents for different sorts of things. You can't have all quarterbacks or all tuba players. You need both. You need mathematicians and history majors alike, and people that have come from different backgrounds, whether they're immigrant families or the first in their family to go to college, whether they, as the president of Harvard said, whether they're from North Dakota or South Beach, Florida. All of that, I think, does make for a vibrant and diverse community. But if you're basically replacing the white privileged kids of doctors and lawyers with black privileged kids of doctors and lawyers, that doesn't seem to me like adding very much diversity.
What if you're not replacing them with black privileged kids of lawyers, but with poorer black or other minority or white kids? What if there was an economic approach? How would you feel about it?
Well, yeah, I think different backgrounds is valuable.
Specifically class.
I'm not an admissions officer, but there's what they try to do is identify potential. So if there are high schools that don't offer AP classes, then you can't expect a kid to have AP classes on his transcript, and that's certainly something to take a look at and make sure that you're not overlooking populations that historically have been underrepresented or schools that historically have not sent kids to college, to Harvard. And so that's definitely on the admissions office of these major prestigious national institutions to make more of an effort to identify those diamonds in the rough.
And does the same kind of logic apply to other preferential treatment, say legacies? This gets a lot of attention, right? We know from other documents that students whose parents attended institutions often get a bump in their applications. Is that legitimate, illegitimate? How does that compare to kind of racial preferences in your mind?
Well, I would argue that if there's some super wealthy alumnus donor, that's a little different. If they want to give $100 million, which would give significant scholarship help to hundreds of students or something like that, that's different than simply having been an alumnus. So you could have exceptions like that because it just benefits so many. But the average legacy preference probably should be done away with. And the curiosity here is that legacy preferences were also developed by Harvard as, again, another way of capping Jewish applicants 100 years ago.
Wait, that's really interesting. So you're more sympathetic to super wealthy donors sort of providing a leg up for their overprivileged kids than for just regular legacies. The rationale is just because it does so much more good for the university via the donation?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that I'm more sympathetic for it. I don't think it's black and white, if you will. But I'm not talking the average donor. You donate $1,000 or something like that annually. But if there's some possibility of significantly changing the nature of campus, building a new library, or something on that order, I mean, it's not the average alumnus. That's not the typical legacy preferences that we're talking about. With those, we should definitely just do away with.
How do you see this playing out? Is this a long trial, multi-steps up to the Supreme Court for a new major ruling? How do you think this advances?
Well, it's unusual in these affirmative action lawsuits to actually have a trial. Typically, they've just been decided on papers as a matter of law, and that gets appealed and ultimately goes up to the Supreme Court. Here, we're actually trying to find facts. We could actually learn something in this trial about, as Harvard defends itself, about how it uses race, what its admissions process is like. That's going to be new. And, I can't predict for you what the opinion of the judge is going to look like, whether ruling for or against Harvard, because there actually are legitimate questions of fact to suss out here. And eventually we'll have a ruling that will be appealed to the First Circuit Court of Appeals. And probably will be at the Supreme Court's doorstep in a year and a half or two.
And one reason it seems this might advance is it's not just Harvard, right? Already there have been similar charges at Yale, and you could imagine this spiraling to other elite universities or public universities, no? Similar kinds of concerns.
I think that's right, and that's partially why Harvard was probably the target of this lawsuit as sort of American higher education. And the Ivy League, and certainly the Ivies. I'm a graduate of Princeton myself. I should disclose, and I don't take any small glee in the crosshairs. But
looks like we
admissions raised.
Yeah, it looks like Ilya's phone is cutting out. But this has been an amazing conversation, and I want to thank Ilya Shapiro, senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute. Tomorrow we'll speak with someone on the other side of this issue, siding with Harvard University. Commercial fishermen in Massachusetts are required to have life jackets on their boats, but they're rarely, if ever, worn. And that's a dangerous practice for the state's lobstermen, for whom falling overboard is a leading cause of death while on the job. Now, a research team is trying to change that outcome by changing the life jackets, not the fishermen. WBUR's Hannah Shinatri brings us this report.
You see anything, Frank?
Steve Holler and Frank Linardis are hauling in a lobster trap. They lean over the edge of the boat and dump its contents into a holding tray. Linardis hauls the 50-pound trap to the back of the boat, rope trailing behind him.
It's a dance between me and him. Him getting that done, me getting this done. Because of his weight, his strength, he'll knock me right on my rear end. And he's done it a few times.
Over the course of the day, they repeat this dance 300 times. Today, everything goes smoothly. But Holler remembers one day in February when a routine haul went very wrong. A few traps had frozen to the deck.
So I was tugging and tugging and tugging with a hook to try and free them up. And they did free up. And I had lost my balance and I was falling backwards.
The fall launched Holler into the freezing Boston Harbor.
It's an absolute shock. First, you're saying, in a split second, you're saying, I can't believe this is happening. And then what sets in is like, I've got to get out of the water. But your body has got a whole different idea.
He managed to grab the last rung of a ladder on the dock and pull himself to safety. Holler wasn't wearing a life jacket, and today, out in the middle of the water, he isn't wearing one either. For many lobstermen like Holler, life jackets get in the way of their work.
Never even considered it.
That's Peter Fredrickson. He's been fishing for over 40 years.
Big, bulky life jackets, number one, you can't work in them, and number two, it's hot. And on a day like today, to have anything else besides shorts and a T-shirt and your rain pants is going to be miserable. So no, I hadn't given it a thought.
The most frequent cause of death in the lobster fishing community is falls overboard.
Julie Sorensen is with the Northeast Center for Occupational Health and Safety. A 16-year study from the Centers for Disease Control found that in every fatal fall, the lobsterman was not wearing a life jacket. But Sorensen acknowledges the barriers to use. In addition to the heat, bulk, and high costs, they can run between $80 and $200, some of the styles with buckles can get caught in traps, making the job even more dangerous. So Sorensen determined it's the life jackets that have to change.
I think you need to assume that people are doing the best they can, and that maybe what we need to do as public health researchers is make it easier and more rewarding for them to do the safer thing or the healthier thing.
Sorensen launched a research project aimed at redesigning the life jackets. She and her team recruited 181 lobstermen in Massachusetts and in Maine to wear different types of life jackets for 4 to 6 weeks. Both Peter Fredrickson and his son Josh, who works as Peter Sternman, participated in the study. Josh says they were given versions that clipped around their waists.
If you live through the 90s, it's like a fanny pack, basically.
The small pack has a CO2 cartridge that deploys if you pull the ripcord, inflating the pack. It's a far cry from the old orange horseshoe vests, but Peter Fredrickson says it's still not perfect.
The belt loosens up and it falls off. It wasn't easy to clean and you get dirty on a lobster boat, but it worked.
Those issues and other feedback from the study are now with the manufacturers, who will use it to reevaluate the designs. The researchers plan to start phase two next summer, using social media and community events to get more lobstermen interested in the new jackets. They may not win over everyone. Back on his boat, Steve Holler says if there was a design that didn't get in his way, he might consider it. But life jackets just aren't his main concern.
I don't think of it that much. There's more hazards on the boat. I could lose fingers. I could get some serious lacerations with the knives, hand injuries, leg injuries. Falling overboard is on my mind, but it's not at the very top, sadly to say.
But for the Fredricksons, the study changed their minds.
I'm going to wear it all the time now. You know, I'm 65 years old. I get up on the gunwale and my balance isn't what it once was. I feel like this. I've never gone over the side, knock on wood, but I could. So it makes sense.
Peter Fredrickson hopes others will take advantage of the new jackets as well. Because lobstermen never think they're going over until the moment they do.
That report from WBUR's Hannah Shinatry. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Evan Horowitz. This is Radio Boston.